supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Today, the mayor's task force to combat the opioid epidemic in Philadelphia announced 18 recommendations to halt the crisis. From WHYY's Behavioral Health Desk, Ann Hoffman reports.
While releasing the recommendations, Mayor Jim Kenney said that Philadelphia families can't afford inaction in the face of the opioid crisis. He said that fighting it will require a comprehensive citywide approach. Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf, who attended the event, echoed that sentiment on a larger scale.
And this task force is really important because this is not a Philadelphia problem. This is a Pennsylvania problem. We have an epidemic.
The recommendations focus on four key areas: prevention and education, treatment, overdose prevention, and the criminal justice system. Thomas Farley, the city's health commissioner, co-chaired the task force. He says there's widespread consensus the epidemic is being fed by overprescribing pain pills.
Physicians and other healthcare providers need to prescribe fewer opioids to fewer patients in lower doses and in shorter durations.
The recommendations encourage educating doctors and consumers about these drugs and establishing insurance policies that support safer opioid prescribing standards. Arthur Evans is the city's former commissioner of behavioral health and intellectual disability services. He says that officials can't treat their way out of this problem.
As a treatment professional, I know that having treatment available is only one part of the challenge. A bigger challenge often is getting people to go to treatment. 90% of the people in the city who have an addiction are not in treatment, and 80% of them don't believe they need to be in treatment. We have to do something to educate the community, to educate people, to reduce stigma.
The recommendations also encourage SEPTA police to start carrying the anti-overdose drug naloxone. Another recommendation encourages the city to keep exploring safe injection sites, places where people can use illegal drugs with medical personnel on standby in case of an overdose. Farley says Canada has found success with that approach, but here in Philadelphia, there would be a host of legal challenges that would act as barriers. He says the recommendations are realistic and could make a real difference, but not overnight.
This crisis really took many years to develop. It's going to take years for us to turn it around.
Ann Hoffman, WHYY News.
This is the final installment of WHYY's series exploring the lives of immigrants living in the United States without legal status. It's called Life Unauthorized.
He told me you're supposed to come back to Mexico.
I feel sad, angry, and not cheerful.
Back at home, I would be in danger.
I agree with what Donald Trump has been doing about getting all the criminals out.
I'm just trying to stay on the right path.
If we know there's an individual that we're looking for in that city, we will arrest that individual in that city.
Fear was a common theme in the seven stories we shared this week. Fear of deportation, of losing a job, of family separation. Much of that fear is directed at the men and women who carry out immigration arrests. In our country, immigration and customs enforcement officers. This evening, we're going to hear from the New Jersey Field Office Director for John Soukaris to try to get to the bottom of recent reports of arrests or raids that have stoked these fears. WHYY's Laura Benchoff spoke with Soukaris earlier this week.
So, right off the bat, what do you see is the biggest change in how the U.S. is enforcing immigration laws under President Donald Trump?
In the prior administration, we had three priorities defined. They were the public safety threats in terms of people with felony convictions, gang membership. The second priority was multiple misdemeanor convictions. And the third priority was anyone that was ordered deported after January 1st, 2014. Under the new directive and the new executive order, there are no specific priorities. So basically, there are no individuals exempt from the enforcement of the immigration laws. We still prioritize the public safety threats. However, any removable alien that we encounter is subject to arrest.
In the immigration conversation, there's a lot of focus on borders, but, you know, New Jersey, where you cover, isn't anywhere near the U.S. southern border. So can you give me a rundown of what a day in the life of an ICE agent who works for you looks like?
All the individuals that we are seeking, we know who they are, and we're targeting them specifically. Once someone is arrested, we bring them back to the office. They get processed. The fingerprints are taken, and they're issued a charging document, which tells them what the immigration charges are, and they generally go to court before the immigration judge. Once that process is over, that individual, our officers coordinate with the foreign embassies to issue a passport or travel document in order to effect the individual's removal from the United States.
I want to ask also about how, quote-unquote, sanctuary city policies affect your work. You know, we have quite a few in this region, and the mayors of sanctuary cities often say, you know, they're happy to hand over people when ICE provides a warrant. Could you explain why, from ICE's point of view, it's helpful for those detainer requests to be honored?
Counties that do not honor the immigration detainer, I believe, put their citizens or community members at risk because they are releasing individuals with very serious crimes versus turning them over to ICE for arrest and processing and removal ultimately. I understand there's some cities that designate themselves as sanctuary cities. If we know there's an individual that we're looking for in that city, we will arrest that individual in that city.
I do a bit of immigration coverage for our station, and when there is immigration enforcement in our region, I wind up calling local and national ICE officials to hear their side. And I do often get a response that contradicts the version of events that eyewitnesses or local attorneys say that the ICE officers have taken. ICE will say, yes, this was targeted. And then people there will say, no, they stopped people without warrants. It wasn't targeted. Why might there be two different versions of reality when it comes to what actually happens during an immigration arrest?
I really can't answer that. I mean, we, like I said, our operations are targeted. There are sometimes media reports, and we get questions, media questions. If we were at a bus station or if we were in a certain church or mosque or some public area, and it later turns out that it was like a police department that was doing some type of enforcement action, and they mistaken us, those people, for ICE. So there's a lot of things that are reported that may not be 100% accurate, but all our operations are going after specific individuals. They're not just go out in the street and whoever you could find. That's really not the case at all.
What is it like to be a person who wears the ICE uniform and enforces immigration laws in a time when there are a lot of these critical headlines about the work that you do? You know, drawing attention to things like people being arrested as they go to immigration court, or people who are being picked up for immigration offenses in places that we weren't seeing it before. And that attention is often critical.
I mean, I know you mentioned the court arrests. Usually they're done in for higher level crimes, and usually they're done in situations where we have not been able to locate that individual elsewhere. That's a very difficult question. I mean, ICE agents and officers were here to enforce the laws of the United States. And sometimes, we do get criticized, I believe, unfairly, because we have to follow the law. We're an executive branch agency, and what we tell our officers is that they're doing the job they were hired to do. They're enforcing the laws, and I believe most of the country's behind us.
That was Immigrations and Customs Enforcement Field Office Director John Soukaris speaking with WHYY's Laura Benchoff for our series Life Unauthorized. To read and listen to the series in its entirety, visit newsworks.org/lifeunauthorized. For Newsworks blogger Solomon Jones, the sound of gunshots in his neighborhood is both personal and unacceptable. For him, there cannot be a next time.
The popping sound that echoed outside my bedroom window was painfully familiar. I hadn't heard that sound in years. But as afternoon gave way to evening and the heat of a warm spring day began to dissipate, there they were, gunshots, and they were close. I sprang from the bed and dressed hurriedly. My son ran to the backyard and urged my wife to come inside. My daughter peered out the window, curious to find the source of the disturbance. And in the few moments it took for my wife to call 911, the peace we'd cultivated over a period of years cracked like a piece of porcelain. Perhaps next time it will shatter completely. That's why we work to make sure next time never arrives. I know the importance of avoiding the next time because for me, the sound of gunshots is like an echo from my distant past. It is a past in which I chose the streets over peace, inebriation over sobriety, and chaos over stability. It is a past in which I suffered through an addiction. Nearly 21 years have passed since the last time I roamed the drug-infested streets of North Philly, and still, few things remind me of the addiction I left behind like the distinctive sound of gunshots. It is a sound that speaks loudly, telling us that no one is safe, telling us that hope is futile, telling us that no one cares, telling us in no uncertain terms that bullets have no names. I learned that lesson one night in the late 90s when gunshots rang out as I tried to buy drugs near Susquehanna Avenue. A bullet pierced my car just behind the driver's seat, and in that moment, the difference between life and death was mere inches. It took more than bullets to make me leave those streets behind. It took determination and grit and prayer, but most of all, it took a desire for something better. I found something better when I got clean. I found my wife, we had our children, and we wanted more than gunshots for them. I wanted them to know the peace of a still backyard, the joy of a clean, safe street, and the security of living in a place where police are there to protect and serve. We found that on a quiet block in East Mount Airy, and we fully intend to protect it. We will cooperate with our neighbors, hold political leaders accountable, and work with the police officers with whom we formed relationships. The gunshots must stop, and we must make them, because the most dangerous moment in the world is next time.
Solomon Jones writes the Philadelphia Experiment at newsworks.org. Over 1,000 of the nation's leading pollsters are crunching the numbers in the Crescent City this weekend. That's where we find Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. Hi, Frank.
Hello, Dave.
Well, Frank, presumably putting New Orleans' endless enticements to the side, what are American Association for Public Opinion Research annual conference attendees attending to this year?
Well, that's an excellent question. We're from all over the map. A lot of academics here from universities, a lot of government pollsters. Then a lot of people from private companies like Gallup were all gathered together to try to figure out how to do a better job at analyzing public opinion. And Dave, given the timing, I mean, the first conference we've had, it's in May every year after the election last year. Not surprisingly, quite a few of the sessions are looking at public opinion polling, not only trying to predict the election last fall, but also in what the election told us.
What are the takeaways from a polling postmortem?
Well, the association, APOR, which is what we call it, did a big review of the polls, and I guess I would summarize it as follows. National polls were actually quite accurate in a historical record. Hillary Clinton won nationally. The average of national polls had her winning, so actually that's a pretty good performance. Primary polls, actually, I was just in a session this morning, were pretty good as well on average. Very hard to predict primary results. But when you look at all of the polls predicting the primaries, both the Democrat and Republican last year, against history, they were actually pretty good as well. Where the polls fell down was state polls predicting the final results. Polls in Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and other Midwestern states were off.
Frank, is that due in part because these state polls use different methodology than national pollsters?
That's a very good question, and they do. The state polls are more likely to use robot calls. We call them IVR, interactive voice response calls, where it's an automated voice, whereas the national polls are more likely to use the tried-and-true random sample phone calls. I think one of the differences is as well is that the quality of the state polls isn't as high. It's very expensive to do them. There are just not as many of them as there used to be in some states. Also, the state polls didn't poll up to the end. The last poll in Wisconsin, a critical state, which Trump won and everybody predicted that Clinton would win, the last poll was done about a week or more before the election, and the evidence seems to suggest there were a lot of late turning toward Trump in this election. So the problem is when you look at state polls, they're not of the same quality, I don't think, as the national polls, and that's an issue.
APOR's theme this year is embracing change and diversity in public opinion and social science research. Let's take them in turn. What are they referring to by change?
When the first APOR meetings, and this association was founded in the 1940s, were held, everybody was talking about randomly sampling, sending the interviewers with clipboards out to farms and homes across the country and asking questions. And, of course, that's changed radically since then. So a lot of the changes that we're looking at are how to do the polls, right? Cell phones are much a part of what everybody does, but there's web polls now, of course. A lot of people like to bring together big samples of people on the web. A lot of looks at the conference here at how to use smartphones. Those are some of the examples of the kind of changes in methods that pollsters are looking at going forward.
Let's take up next the aspect of the conference attending to diversity in public opinion.
Diversity means, I think, when the organizers put this together, that we have to make sure we're getting all types of people in our polls, but also that we're looking at the issues that relate to diversity in the country. Actually, Gallup's been working with scientists at UCLA in California, trying to figure out the best way to survey and find samples of individuals who identify themselves as transgender. Very interesting and politically important population.
Thank you, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, Editor-in-Chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on Newsworks Tonight. Tomorrow, Philadelphia's Kensington neighborhood will host its annual Kinetic Sculpture Derby. The festival features a parade of pedal-powered contraptions topped with wacky decorations. It's a chance for local artists and creative types to strut their stuff. And this year, some high school students from West Philadelphia are entering the fray. WHYY's Avi Wolfman-Arendt reports.
On Thursday morning, the workshop school in West Philadelphia was a symphony of drills and saws and welding torches. And in the middle of it all, two tandem bicycles welded together and topped, or in the process of being topped, with a massive wooden cutout of a brain.
So I would mount it on the backside so it's flat, right?
For the past 6 weeks, teacher Jared Lauterbach has led a group of ninth graders here through the design and construction of two kinetic sculptures. On Saturday, they'll pedal up Frankfort Avenue and eventually encounter a massive mud pit at the end of the route.
It kind of removes me from the teaching role as, like, I'm grading you, and it's like life grades them.
That's part of the philosophy at the Workshop School, an experimental high school where students learn by doing intricate hands-on projects. Treasure Jackson is one of the freshmen working on the kinetic sculptures.
When I first got here, I was like, I don't want to do this hands-on stuff because I like getting my nails done, as you can see.
She's since learned how to change a tire and her perspective.
When I had to get dirty for a grade, I was just like, this is so much fun.
You can check out the school's creation starting around noon Saturday at the corner of Trenton and Norris Streets in Kensington. Avi Wolfman-Arendt, WHYY News.
The Pittsburgh Penguins are in the midst of a contentious fight. No, not for the Stanley Cup, but for the future of a major development project. 10 years ago, when the team threatened to leave the city, a new arena and exclusive development rights convinced them to stay. Now, that development is the subject of a fair housing complaint, which could be decided any day, as Keystone Crossroads' Margaret J. Krause reports.
In Pittsburgh's Hill District neighborhood, there's an empty 28-acre stretch of city-owned land. Standing on a hill, Carl Redwood looks down at the site. It's covered in parking lots, used by commuters and hockey fans headed to the PPG Paints Arena. Redwood points out that the arena was built with state and city money. In exchange, the Penguins agreed to develop this vast bald spot. Redwood objects to the deal the city made.
So they went ahead and they improved plan of the Penguins to develop the lower hill without including housing set aside for people who are very low income.
The site is slated to become a mixed-use, mixed-income development with businesses, entertainment, and more than 1,000 apartments. It's the apartments and what the rent will be that worry Redwood. He runs the Hill District Consensus Group. In December 2015, the group filed a fair housing complaint against the plan with the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development.
Our argument is because there's not one single unit that they plan to build that will be affordable for an average black family, that the result of their plan will discriminate against black families and is a violation of the Fair Housing Act.
20% of the apartments planned for the first phase of building will be rented to lower-income families, people who make about $32,000 a year. But Redwood says that's the problem. The average black family in Pittsburgh makes only about $26,000.
When they say mixed income, what they mean is moving rich families into low-income communities and displacing low-income folks. And here in the Lower Hill, they have a great opportunity to kind of correct that. They can build a whole new community.
How to build that community has been a decade-long conversation, and housing has been one of the biggest sticking points. In 2008, all the stakeholders signed a community benefits agreement, which laid out a plan for the site and set some expectations for affordable housing. But in 2014, the Penguins signed a new agreement with fewer stakeholders that ultimately lowered the number of affordable apartments. Councilman Daniel Lavelle represents the Hill District. He says they got the best deal they could, but he'd love to see more affordability.
All of us need to benefit from this development, and investing in the least of us is to all of our benefit.
Lavelle says he gets both sides. The community should benefit from development, and development is hard. For him, the tricky part is finding the right balance.
Our future is dependent on it. We get this wrong, and we will literally continue to push out. We'll create a playground for the wealthy, and we won't have a truly mixed income viable community.
Carlos Torres is executive director of the Pittsburgh Commission on Human Relations. The commission investigates allegations of discrimination, including in housing. He wasn't familiar with the Lower Hill complaint, but he says because the city receives federal money, it must further fair housing.
The city has an obligation to purposely overcome patterns of segregation and the denial of access of opportunity that are part of our nation's history.
Housing in the Lower Hill has been an issue for 60 years. In the late 1950s, an urban renewal project evicted 8,000 people. The city used eminent domain to bulldoze nearly 80 city blocks for an arts district that never really materialized, with the exception of a civic arena. It hosted concerts, rallies, and later became the first home of the Pittsburgh Penguins. The effects of that urban renewal project are still felt today in the Hill District.
Development of the arena changed the street grid, changed the traffic patterns, and changed the way that people related to this neighborhood.
That's Terry Baltimore. She gives tours of the Hill District as part of her work with the Hill House Association. She says the 1950s Lower Hill development cut the neighborhood off from the rest of the city.
And if you don't come to a place, you don't think about it. It's like place and the people are invisible.
Right.
Demolition of the Civic Arena in 2012 cleared the way for the Penguins' new development. Kevin Acklin is the mayor's chief of staff, as well as the city's chief development officer. He says he knows not everyone is happy with the level of affordability.
The realities are, how do you pay for it? It's easy to commit to a number. It's hard to actually implement it. We own the land, but we don't control the development.
More than $12 million of public money has been used to prepare the site for development, building roads and putting in utilities. The Pittsburgh Penguins did not respond to repeated requests for comment. A decision in the fair housing complaint is expected soon. Margaret J. Krause, Keystone Crossroads.
Keystone Crossroads is a statewide initiative reporting on challenges facing Pennsylvania cities. WHYY leads the four-station partnership. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. At the controls this week, Diana Martinez and Adam Staniszewski. Sandra Clark is Vice President of News and Civic Dialogue. John Mussoni is Assistant Vice President for News Operations, and our News Director is Eugene Son. Thanks for joining us and have a great weekend. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.